Hi, it's Ian Pickus back in the Congressional Corner with our longtime friend David Hawkins, associate editor of the Almanac of American Politics. And we're speaking as well as on audio, as per usual, on video. So you can watch our conversation at WAMC.org for better or worse. Hey, David, how are you?
Nice to be looking you in the eye.
So we're speaking after the 4th of July, which was this deadline that President Trump had put in place to get his domestic agenda through the Congress. Are you surprised that they were able to hit the deadline that he wanted?
I guess I was until my default cynicism kicked in at the very end, which was that what it looked like until close to the very end was that there would be just enough super hardline fiscal hawk conservative freedom caucus types combined with a handful of centrists in the Senate to keep the thing in limbo. But that didn't happen. I guess when I say my default cynicism, it's just that the time and time again, the Freedom Caucus folks especially have made very dogmatic noises about saying no. And then once they're taken to the closed door back room and told that Donald Trump will hate them and make sure and have give them primaries and give them agita for the rest of their lives if they don't vote for what he wants, they vote for it. So that's exactly what happened. It's the so-called Freedom Caucus, these people who market themselves as the most dogmatic and uncompromising conservatives are now being ridiculed by Washington reporters as the freedom to fold caucus or the freedom to do whatever Donald Trump wants caucus.
So what do you make of the evolution of Republican dogma in Congress about the deficit? Because this bill adds a bunch more on, which traditionally would have been anathema.
Right. The sort of deficits don't matter thought in, among Republicans has sort of waxed and waned. Depending on what else the Republicans want to get done. Deficits don't matter was famously a line of in the Reagan administration, a couple of the fiscal policy cabinet secretaries back when Ronald Reagan was president. You know, he wanted to do his defense buildup and his tax cuts way, way back when. And even then, the fiscal hawks, the deficit hawks, these were much smaller deficits by today's standards. But they were sort of told to pipe down. And then deficits became super important. And then they went away. I mean, you know, we're running a surplus back when Bill Clinton was president and right up until 9/11. Of course, deficits ever since. But even in those times, there have been times when the Republicans have said, oh, we need to address, for example, the COVID pandemic. That was sort of the last time there was bipartisan agreement in Congress on fiscal policy was at the start of COVID. One of the big reasons why the debt, which is the difference in the debt and the deficit, the debt, just to remind everybody, is essentially the debt is the sum total of every year's deficit plus interest. So the debt soared during both Trump 1 and Biden, because there was bipartisan consensus to spend oceans and oceans of money trying to get the economy back on its feet during COVID. So it's not the deficits being the driving, the organizing principle of conservative Republicans is only sometimes.
And before we talk about some details about what's actually included in the package, I want to talk about how President Trump deals with Congress, because I was thinking, you know, back in the first term, he was really grasping for any sort of big legislative wins from Congress. And we had talked at that time when you were on this show about how every week was infrastructure week, you know, but it never actually happened. So has he gotten sort of better at dealing with the leadership, or is it just that there are different people there?
I think he has leaders who are more to his liking. I think the so-called doing the one big beautiful bill, high risk but high reward, that he essentially, you know, another cliche in Washington is often used in discussing financial services and banking is too big to fail. This thing was so big and had so many pieces in it, and Trump had staked his entire, essentially his entire domestic policy record for a second term on this, that it did become sort of too big to fail. And he has done a remarkable thing to the way he has brought Republicans in Congress to heel to his agenda, even more so this time than it did the last time. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not only by his own persuasive tactics. It's also some pretty rough knuckle stuff, as I say, behind the scenes, where he, as soon as anybody crosses him, you know, they're sort of dead to him and they should face a primary challenge that next time. I mean, he, you know, he kind of runs it like a mob boss a little bit, and he's getting away with it.
Now, in the House, of course, it passed by one vote. In the Senate, there was some conjecture about senators who might not like aspects of the bill who were on the fence before they fell in line. So people like Hawley and Murkowski, what did they all get to get them to yes?
So I'm not sure exactly what Hawley got. He sort of folded his tent a little earlier than Murkowski. Murkowski was the final holdout, right? And if she'd gone the other way, Bill would have been in pretty big trouble. What I think I can say this in two sentences, that the one sort of tangible thing that she got was this this wrinkle in the bill that helps Alaska in particular on Medicaid, but in so doing, it privileges states with inefficient Medicaid programs.
Two sentences. I think you did it.
There it is. So that's what I did. That's I'm not going to try to add any more. So Alaska's Medicaid gets special treatment, but the way they had to write it in order to pass the parliamentarians muster, they had to essentially also cut a break to Medicaid states with Medicaid that is poorly run. So not good governance. Not probably what Lisa Murkowski wants to be known for, but that's how she that's what she got in return. And you know, there's special favors for one or two states. That goes back a long, long time, and it's often Alaska and Hawaii. They claim that by being non-contiguous with the rest of the country, they deserve all kinds of special treatment.
And I guess it's math. I mean, from Murkowski's perspective, she had some cards to play and she had a lot of leverage because of the margins. They needed J.D. Vance to break the tie. So, I mean, from Alaska's perspective, I guess she was doing what she should have done.
That is her argument, or that's the argument of her fans. The sort of countervailing criticism is, even after getting this sweetener for Alaska, she continued to speak out of both sides of her. I once actually heard Charlie Rangel of New York, famous Charlie Rangel of Manhattan,
who just died recently,
who passed away recently, was a very voluble, funny man, and for all of his flaws. And he liked to say, "This is the worst bill I've ever voted for." That was sort of one of his little jokes. And there was a little bit of that in Murkowski. She even said, "I, you know, this is not a good bill. I sure hope the House fixes it." That was her line. And it did look for a few hours as though the House might insist on fixing it, which would have then obviously pushed it back. This artificially created Independence Day deadline. We just think that Donald Trump had all the flyovers. There were four different flyovers during the signing ceremony. He had all the jets on standby and he wanted to use those jets and see the big machines and hear the big booming cannons while he signed the bill and hold the gavel. He made sure that Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, actually brought him a toy to play with, which was the gavel that was used to ring down the winning vote. That was the deadline. There was no real deadline. Sometimes Congress faces real deadlines. You know, you go beyond them and there are cascading fiscal policy consequences. This was just a deadline in Donald Trump's mind.
So what do we know about the Johnson-Thune-Trump sort of triumvirate right now, based on this experience of the big bill getting through?
I mean, I think it is not unfair to say that Mike Johnson is more of a wholly owned subsidiary of the White House than any other speaker that I've ever witnessed, which goes back to the 1980s. He does not see himself as it does not act as though he sees himself as the leader of half of an independent branch of the government. He essentially found out from the president what the president wanted and did his best to deliver that. So in that sense, and even doing that has required a significant amount of personal skill and persuasive powers. And I think, you know, he has now exceeded many expectations, remembering, it seems so many years ago, what was it, 3 years ago, when he became the speaker, he was like the fifth or sixth choice of his fellow Republicans, didn't have any experience really in the leadership, totally untested. He has exceeded those expectations in part by putting himself in the service of Trump. I think Thune, has done enough on some other matters to suggest he'll be a little different, that he's not quite the same. Most importantly, probably in terms of, for those of us who pay attention to the balance of power, hard to remember maybe, but when Trump first became inaugurated in January and Thune was in his first hours as majority leader, Trump tried to persuade Thune to just confirm all of his cabinet secretaries without any hearings or background checks, you know, and Thune stuck up for the Senate's prerogatives to at least take a look at these nominees before they voted on them. So he's done a few things like that that make you think that he's not totally beholden the way Johnson seems to be.
So let's talk now, David, about what's actually in the bill itself. Democrats who, you know, dominate seats in the Northeast on this show have said this is bad news for people who need health care. It's bad news for people who need food assistance. It takes wealth and rips it from the needy and gives it to people who don't need it. How much of that criticism is borne out by the language of the bill?
A decent amount. I mean, and those are just two. I mean, it's going to make it the bill. I have my cheat sheet here, which is my two page. It's really a lot going on in the bill. Makes it harder to get student loans. It'll make it harder to get a student loan to go to community college, for example. It eliminates lots of subsidies and tax breaks and programs for the green economy, which was employing more and had been employing more and more people. Of course, in journalism, you know, you have to summarize these bills in simple language. Because nobody on TV or radio, let alone in a newspaper or a magazine, can write, you know, 10,000 words about the bill every day. But it's sprawling,
and it's 900 pages long.
It is 900 pages long, and it's got many different provisions, including things that get very little aid. I mean, you know, not a lot of people are talking about the big boosts in spending for border enforcement and for defense, for example. And then, as I say, education, energy, right? Just the tax code, the way it does help. I think your New York members are, in the end, grudgingly happy with what happened to the so-called SALT deduction.
Yes. Well, the ones who were saying they wouldn't vote for it if it wasn't fixed voted for it. I mean, so I guess that's where that left off.
And I don't know. I can't even remember. In the end,
it was raised,
yes. But only a little, much less than what those guys wanted.
Yes, that's true.
Right. So, but yes, in the main, it preserves many tax breaks that were already benefiting the wealthy, and it creates new cuts, most remarkably or notably or directly in Medicaid. The amount to be saved from Medicaid is almost, I think, equivalent to the amount to be saved is almost the same as the amount to be of revenue to be lost in tax breaks for the wealthiest.
So let me ask you this, you know, and you mentioned your cynicism, and I'll raise you one. From what I see in polling, people don't like anything ever. But when a bill like this one was put to poll respondents, they said they don't like it. It's not very popular. And of course, it's going to take a while to see what the impacts of the bill will be. I mean, it's over a period of time. But does it matter that the big, beautiful bill is not polling well with people?
I think it does matter. I think obviously, you know, to speak in cliches, we had a long way to go to the midterm election. The news is happening at such a pace that, you know, who knows what the country is going to be thinking about next September and October. But I think Congress is not likely to make any other headlines between now and the next election. Congress itself, in other words, this is the Trump domestic agenda. There are not going to be additional policy bills to advance what Trump wants to do. So this is it. This is what members of Congress are running on or against.
And why is that? I'm sorry to interrupt, but I mean, there are usually a number of bills that happen on a certain schedule and so on during a congressional term. So you think that this was kind of the big moment for them?
I think just glancing at my cheat sheet over here, they're rolling what could have been, you know, 8 or 9 bills that would have made the front page by themselves into one. So the only thing I think they're going to spend their time doing is what this bill does not address are the routine spending decisions that have to happen every year, the so-called appropriations process, which is essentially about, in very round terms, only about a quarter of what the government spends is decided by Congress on a year-by-year basis. And they got to do that. They're supposed to do it by October 1st every year. No way that's going to happen because all their attention has been diverted onto this. But in terms of shifting big policies between now and next fall, I can't see it happening, in part because in many midterm years, they stop trying by about Memorial Day of the election year.
And then they start they keep running.
Yeah, because they're running, right? So all that's a long way of saying this is what the Republicans have to brag about, and this is what Democrats have to excoriate. And I think it was a pretty risky move. That it's not popular in many ways. The Democrats have lots of ways to message this in ways that could turn off swing voters.
I was talking about this in the newsroom, though. I wonder what you make of my theory, because one of my coworkers was saying the same thing, which is like people will feel the effect of the bill and they'll have to blame someone for that. But what do you do if the rules of the game have changed to the extent where the president will just stand up and say, Joe Biden did that, not me? You know, like, do people actually, are they able to follow a paper trail enough to make a decision in November 2026 that is based on what Congress just did here in July?
It's obviously a great question. I mean, it is hard to shadow box against somebody who takes such a broad view of his ability to frame issues. How's that for a euphemism? It's hard to counter-program that in an effective way. The Democrats have not done it in an effective way in recent years. And as I say, the other unknown is, you know, what are we going to be talking about next summer? Are we going to be talking about things happening overseas? Are we going to be talking about, you know, Iran and Israel back at war, or Ukraine and Russia, something happening there, or a Supreme Court vacancy, or, you know, name 6 other things, or more trouble for Donald Trump, or some other scandal that engulfs him. I don't know. If the election were this fall, I think the Democrats would have enough what I like to call comma-free points to make. You know, that's not non-complicated, simple declarative sentences that they could they would have a shot at overcoming Trump's marketing skills. But he is an amazing, his liberal use of fact versus fiction has had amazing capacity to shape the country's mind.
So to that end, do you subscribe to the traditional conventional wisdom that the midterms favor the out of power party, or do you think that's an open question? Because the election, as you say, is next year, not this year.
Right. I mean, historically, they do. Political scientist nerds are already since, of course, we haven't had a split 2-term presidency since the 19th century and only once before. There is historically a difference between what a midterm how a midterm affects the president's party in his first term, which is generally much more emphatically than how it affects his party in a second term. But of course, in every other example, those two terms have come together. Now, this second term is in some ways like a first term all over again. So, but in general, this is what this is how the country expresses its views on the president, is with their vote for or against his party's members of Congress. So I do think that's more obvious in the House, because it's the entire House, all 435 seats up. Senate is a different animal. Only a third of the seats are up in every election. And next year, as it turns out, the 35 seats or 34 seats that are in play next year aren't that awful. It's not that awful a map for the Republicans. In fact, it's an okay map for the Republicans.
So let's talk a bit about the Democratic leadership. You know, I saw this clip that was making the rounds in New York of Senator Schumer on the floor saying, I got the name of the bill changed because it's not big and beautiful. It seems to me they don't really have a lot of cards to play because of the math being what it is. But how do you see Schumer and Jeffries as the loyal opposition halfway through this first year?
I think they're both still struggling with essentially Democrats in Congress, struggling how to come up with a unified, consistent message between Democrats who themselves are of several different minds about how they should be responding to Trump. I mean, there are some who think they should just ignore Trump. There's probably the plurality of them who think they should fight him at every turn, even when they know they're going to lose. And there's a third bunch that really does want to find the small but pivotal group, the ones who are in the most purple districts or the most purple states, who need to look like they're collaborating, who are trying to find ways to agree with Trump whenever they can, so they can look like repairs of the breach and, you know, what at least some voters say they want. So trying to come up with a cohesive message that makes all three of those bunches happy is tough. As I say, I think the plurality, the biggest of those three, is the fight him at every turn, never say die, charge into the breach even when you know you're going to lose. And that was who, for example, Hakeem Jeffries was speaking to in his 8.5 hour, don't call it a filibuster.
The House doesn't have one, right?
Yeah, the House doesn't have a filibuster, but it was this weird trick where if you're the majority leader or the minority leader, it's called the magic minute. You're technically only supposed to speak for a minute, but you can speak for as long as you like. I mean, that was what that was all about. Hakeem Jeffries knew that they were going to lose the votes. The whip, both sides have whips, vote counters, who knew what the result was going to be. This was just to get on TV and to make him look like he was leading the valiant, if somewhat quixotic, charge.
So, you know, that brings to mind the question of the next big election in 2028. You know, if you look closely, you can see Democrats who are taking some steps to get ready for it. Who are some of the potential candidates that, you know, we should be looking for right now in the next presidential race?
Among the Democrats, right?
We're
just going to talk about it. Yeah.
Because I know the other thing is a quote unquote elephant in the room.
Yes, there is that elephant in the room. It's an enormous list. I'm not going to do it justice, but it probably starts with several governors. It starts with Gavin Newsom, takes in J.D. Pritzker, comes east to Andy Beshear in Kentucky. There are three. Chime in with more governors if you got governors.
Gretchen Whitmer, maybe?
Gretchen Whitmer, maybe. And then there are people who formerly thought they might be. Oh, and of course, I would say the most important governor to mention is Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania. And then Pete Buttigieg still wants to be president. I guess Gretchen Whitmer may still want to be president. Then there's a long list of senators. You know, the oldest joke in Washington is every senator looks in the mirror every morning and sees the next president. One that intrigues me is a woman named Elise Slotkin, who is the new senator from Michigan. She was the one who was asked to deliver the response to Trump's first State of the Union address. That's historically been sort of a non-starter as a presidential launching pad, but I think she's a very effective communicator. There are many.
I didn't hear you say the name Kamala Harris in that list.
I did not say the name Kamala Harris in that list. I just don't think the Democrats are going to go back down that road again, and I don't. And then, of course, closer to home, closer to where you're sitting right now, no conversation about politics is complete without the name of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Is this her moment? I mean, is this peak performance? Is this, you know, does she think she can capitalize on what's happened in the New York City mayoral race, and that this is a signal that a progressive really can win and really can lead a coalition that is ideologically broad? Maybe. The Democrats have not looked, historically, have not given presidential aspirants a second bite of the apple. Does she really want to take her bite of the apple at this point? Or, I mean, Obama did. Obama took a huge risk. Yeah. I think we fail to remember, you know, just what an enormous risk that was, that he'd been in the Senate for 2 years when he decided to take on, I mean, almost nobody was talking about the Democratic contest in 2008. Everybody just assumed it was going to be Hillary Clinton. And yet he thought that the trajectory of his little supernova star is like the next new thing, that it wouldn't last more than a couple of years and he better take a shot. So maybe that's what she'll conclude. Maybe that's what others will conclude as well.
So we'd have to go back to Adlai Stevenson, I think, for a two-time Democratic nominee. So, I mean, you're talking the 1950s. You're right. Maybe. But also, I just wonder, because it's not like Kamala Harris got a quote-unquote, you know, fair shot at winning a nomination and having her own campaign. You know, she was an emergency lever that was pulled, and who knows what would have happened otherwise. So if I was her, I could see wanting to go again.
All true. She doesn't, I mean, I'm not going to claim to be totally plugged in on what she's been doing with her life, but I think the conventional wisdom is that if she runs for governor of California, that means she will not be running for president.
That's what I've heard.
And I think those who are trying to read the tea leaves says that seems to be what she's preparing to do. So.
Okay, so with that, let's go back to the elephant in the room. In past conversations, you have raised the specter, and you're not alone in this, that Donald Trump doesn't want to go anywhere and may not in 2028. Do you still think that's true?
I guess I'm softening in that view a little bit. I think he doesn't want to go anywhere, and he certainly doesn't want to leave the impression that he's going anywhere. So I think at a minimum, he will continue to make these little teases and rhetorical teases, and may even supplement them by launching a super PAC or starting to raise money or doing other signals to just, he does not want to be perceived as a lame duck. And so I think he'll definitely keep his options open and make it seem like, you know, he could do the unprecedented and the seemingly, to my
illegal,
11th grade English understanding of the Constitution, seemingly unconstitutional move to run again. Do I think he's actually going to? Maybe I'm starting to think he's not, but he wants to make everybody, he wants to tease it for as long as possible for maximum political leverage. And then beyond, but I do think if he doesn't, he's the kingmaker. I do think that he still has such a grip on the Republican Party that if he says clearly who he thinks the next president should be, that person is overwhelmingly likely to be the Republican nominee in 2028. And I think that, I mean, J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio were the first two to come to mind. There's, you know, Donald Jr., I think, wants to be in that discussion. I'm not sure if he really is, but there you go.
Let me give you one more. Someone who would be pulling an inside straight, I think, based on where this year started. But if Elise Stefanik wins the race for governor of New York, and it seems pretty likely that she's going to run for it, or mm-hmm. she'd like us to think that, she should run for president 2 years later. I mean, why wouldn't you? Republicans haven't won a statewide election in New York State since 2002.
Right. So that's right. So if she were to win in 26,
mm-hmm.
then she'd be up again in 30.
Yeah. Talk about carpe diem.
Right. And she likes to carpe the diem. that's kind of been her modus operandi. Governors, I mean, you know, this is why Shapiro didn't run 2 years after he became governor. There is sort of a, there can be a bit of a backlash if you, because as a practical matter, running for president in 2028 it means giving it the majority of your headspace starting pretty early in 2027. So I don't know, I don't remember enough of what I should remember about the rhythm of the New York state budget and legislative session, but she'd probably have to take her eye off that ball even before she got her first budget through or before her first set of legislative priorities through. And that would tick off New Yorkers, and it would tick off even her supporters, I think, could tick them off. And it just, I mean, yes, she seems to have, I mean, you and I know that that there's tangible, objectively provable evidence of her opportunism and the way she switched from being a never Trumper to a Trumper.
Well, it happened on this show, among other places.
Right there at that microphone. But that's an opportunism that voters sometimes really don't like. You get to be governor of a big state and you immediately start running for president. I mean, it was a knock on Barack Obama in Illinois when he, you know, even among some swing voters, was that he was a senator really for 2 years before he started running for president. And even then it was like, oh, he's just using us as a stepping stone. And that can hurt you. So I don't know. But on the other hand, there is, as I was just saying about AOC, you know, you got to calculate the arc of your star, of your shooting star, and decide whether it's a long arc or a short arc, and then make your choice accordingly.
Yeah, you don't always get a lot of chances to grab that brass ring, and not in this game. So with that, let's wind up and talk about the checks on the president, such as they are. The Supreme Court's wrapped up its term for the year. How do you see the courts dealing with Trump 2.0?
Well, that's right. They've wrapped up their term for the year, but as we saw,
until October, right?
Right, until October. But as we saw just a couple of days ago, before we are having this conversation, they are still tackling the so-called shadow docket, the emergency docket. When we say the term ends, those are the formal cases that go through the whole oral argument and briefing system, the traditional docket. But then there's this other thing, the emergency docket, the shadow docket. That's where much of the action is going to be for Trump. And this is where just a couple of days ago, they allowed him to proceed with plans to fire thousands and thousands of federal workers. So far, the record, he's having an amazingly consistent run of getting to expand presidential power, thanks to the Supreme Court. And so, I mean, I don't think he's really been given a setback yet. There is a policy. This is what I'm saying is different from policies that he's trying to change versus just his approach to governing. I get to do this. Congress has no say. He's doing pretty well on that, or the courts have no say. The other big decision from last month being this ruling from the Supreme Court, 6-3, saying that the lower court federal judges can't stop things from happening nationwide, no matter how palpably unconstitutional or illegal they think they are. Their rulings are limited to the region in which they're serving, so-called nationwide injunctions. That's already changing litigation right before we got on this call. This is on the birthright citizenship case. What the Supreme Court said is you could put together a traditional class action lawsuit with plaintiffs from all over the country, then a single judge can stop something happening nationwide. That just happened, where a class action of people have sued to stop this birthright citizen change, and a judge said, put a stop to it. But in the main,
this was the case heard in New Hampshire.
Correct. But in the main, he's having unfettered expansions of already significant executive power over the legislative branch. And of course, you know, he's not doing it without the help of the legislative branch. which by and large is sitting idly by and letting this happen.
Are you having a good summer, David? I want to end on a high note here.
I'm having a great summer. The ocean is clean. My freelance writing assignments are interesting. My two sons are happy. I love my dog. Life is good.
David Hawkins is associate editor of the Almanac of American Politics, and we love having you on the Congressional Corner. David, go enjoy the beach.
Thanks a lot. See you later, Ian.